Okay. Good morning, everyone. Happy Martin Luther King Day. I see everyone's off from work.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so in honor of Martin Luther King Day, I just wanted to do a short class on the civil rights movement and how it connects to Judaism. Now, before we start, when I was a kid, I think most of us are like this. If it's a holiday like Martin Luther King Day or Veterans Day or Memorial Day, so you just think, oh, it's like a day off of school. And you don't even appreciate what the day is. You know, even July 4th, you know, okay, well, it's the summer anyway. So, you know, I was in camp, so we didn't really talk about July 4th and what it meant. Same thing again with Veterans Day, with Memorial Day, Martin Luther King Day. But as you get older, you start to appreciate these things a little bit more. The significance of a day and a person like Martin Luther King and what he stood for. So what I first wanted to do is just quickly talk a little bit about, you know, the civil rights movement. Obviously, I'm not an expert, and I'm sure you know just as much as me, if not more. Maybe we'll see if anyone has personal recollections of the civil rights movement. Then we'll talk about, I think, two topics. One of them is, are there any Jewish sources which talk about, civil rights and standing up for people? And then the last thing is we'll talk about a little bit protesting and against the government, and, you know, is that justified? Is that okay? And are there any Jewish sources which talk about sort of civil disobedience, which was part of the hallmark of the civil rights movement and those that were fighting for civil rights? So, of course, when you think about civil rights, right, you think about sit-ins, Jim Crow laws, Rosa Parks, Emmett Till, unfortunately, obviously Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, the March on Selma, right? And a lot of these they've made into movies. So those of my generation and later only recognize the civil rights movement through movies. But there are plenty of, there's no shortage of movies. They just came out with Selma, which talks about the march there and what they faced. But there's lots of other movies recently that talk about civil rights and that time period. And then what I found interesting is that apparently in the 14th Amendment, correct me if you know I'm wrong, the 14th Amendment says that all people should be equal, right? Well, it says that in the beginning of the, is it the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal.
Right.
So the 14th Amendment said everyone has to be treated equal, regardless of skin color, right, etc. But I think and religion, everything has to be equal. But I think what happened was that they interpreted that, whether it was the local government or just people in charge and power, whether maybe mostly in the South, but perhaps also in the North, to some extent, is that everyone is equal, but they're not, they're separate. Separate but equal. So what I take that to mean is that, you know, you talk about, you know, bathrooms, right? So the bathrooms are all equal, right? It's not like we have a good bathroom for one set of people and a bad bathroom, inferior quality type of restroom for another group of people, or perhaps schools, right? That we have schools for everyone. They're equal. It's not like we make one better than the other. So everyone has something, and they're not, one's not better than the other, but they're still separate until the Brown versus Board of Education said that if you make two types of schools for two groups of people, and they're not integrated. So then, even if they're both equally, I guess they both get the same number of resources, and they both have good teachers, etc. But the kids in, that are in one group, and they know that they're all in one group, one type of people, feel inferior just because they happen to be separate from everyone else. Even if their school is the same, but it affects their mindset and their learning, knowing that, they're in a separate school, even though it's equal, right? Separate but equal. So I think that's what happened. That case, the Supreme Court said that you have to integrate, right? That's integration. That it's not enough to have equal quality, but it has to be integrated. If one group wants to go to this school or that school, it doesn't matter. Everyone should be able to go and the same school wherever you want. And I think it culminates in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, that obviously changed everything.
That separate and equal is very justified, because I want to be, and this is individualism, the separate.
Okay.
But being treated equal like everybody else. So in some ways, the separate is right, because you want to be what you are.
Yeah, but I don't think it's necessarily, that's true, but I think having separate bathrooms and separate restaurants.
I'm talking about rights, civil rights.
But that would be in your home and in your private life.
What?
Right, I see what you're saying. Meaning, you're saying, okay, we still have to, everyone's still, maybe like you're saying capitalism versus communism kind of thing, that everyone, it's not like we should say everyone should now. Wealth redistribution, everyone should have the same money and the same job, and a doctor shouldn't get paid more than a librarian. Nothing against librarians, right? But everyone's individual. Everyone can strive to be what they want to be, and sometimes people will make more money than other people, that kind of thing. Everyone's individual, but we're talking about as it relates to facilities, like public facilities, swimming pools and bathrooms.
Schools.
And schools, that they're, separate. Obviously, if a group wants to make a school, private school, I don't think is affected. You can have private school just for one group or the other. Jewish schools are, I think they say technically anyone can come to a Jewish private school, but who's going to do that if you're not, part of that? But we're talking about public schools, that they should be actually public for everyone, integrated. So that's from my research. Obviously, I wasn't there, but many of you were. I don't know if you want to share any personal recollections from those days. I know it was more prevalent in the South, with sit-ins. Right.
I grew up in Arizona.
Okay.
And I went to the public schools.
Okay.
And I had a very, very good friend. His name was Jorge Vega.
Okay.
And because of him, I was able to get a job at Hockamy's Department Store.
Okay.
But he couldn't go to school with me. He had to go to school with his people.
His own school, right.
That is America.
That's very interesting that you say that, because I only thought it was more in the Southeast. But you're saying even in the Southwest.
Right.
Right. Which
was not. Now, the Native American people had their own property.
Right.
They had their own schools.
Uh-huh. Oh, so he was Native American?
No.
He was Hispanic.
He was Hispanic.
Right.
Because we drove through a Native American, with my husband.
Mm-hmm.
We drove through an Indian reservation.
Right.
Native American.
Yeah.
Our car broke down.
Uh-huh.
We had to get off of their property.
Oh, they wouldn't help you out?
They would help, but we had an American car. I don't remember the whole thing, but I remember that we had to get somebody to come and help us with our car.
Uh-huh, because they didn't feel... They felt it was their land. They didn't want other people.
They were very nice people.
Right.
But this is the way it was.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
My concern is that we have somebody who is the president of the United States.
Right.
Who's not too kind to differences.
Right.
Right.
That's true. I don't necessarily want to dive into politics, but your point is well taken, that we have to recognize those in our leadership positions have different views on... Obviously, nowadays, things have... Since the Civil Rights Movement, we're 50 years later, things have gotten a lot better, obviously, with opportunities.
Publicized.
Right.
And the press, on the radio, television, everything.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, they say we still have work to do in certain communities, and obviously we talk about with the police and everything. I don't want to get too much into politics. No, it's okay. I'm not, it's just, these things are still in our mind. But obviously we've come a long way from 50s, 60s, that kind of thing. So interestingly, it's well documented that there were Jewish people, Jewish leaders that joined in with the Civil Rights Movement, right? A famous picture of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, right? The famous thinker who marched with Martin Luther King, right? In solidarity. And there's like lots of other... there's lots of other documents that talk about that. Obviously, our stories are sort of related. The Jewish story, the African-American story.
Jews are on the front of civil rights. They were persecuted
absolutely, right.
Always was the Jew, always separate, but equal right now.
So that's how we relate pretty well to, the people in those times that were being persecuted. We had that connection. And so that's why we felt strongly to support them in their movement. Obviously, yes. Okay, so now what I want to do is talk about... and these sources are kind of self-evident, because I would go on a limb and say that even if we didn't have these Jewish sources, obviously standing up for those persecuted should be in every moral code, even if you're not Jewish. But it's reinforced, the idea is reinforced with our tradition. So, for instance... There is a chapter in Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, third chapter, 18th Mishnah, quoting Rabbi Akiva, right? Who said, "Beloved is man, for he was created in the image of God. An even greater expression of love is that when it was made known to him that he was created in the image of God, as it is stated, 'For in the image of God he made man.'" Right? And so that shows us that everyone has, a piece of God in them, has a divine nature to them.
But God is not always kind also. So we are the image, kind and not kind.
Okay, I'm not talking about... No, I'm not talking about God. I'm talking about within every person, they have something... We all have something special within us.
Right.
That's all we're saying. So... there was a rabbi in the 1960s, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, and he wrote about this, and he was very in favor of civil rights in the 60s. And he says, from the standpoint of the Torah, there can be no discrimination, no distinction between one human being and another on the basis of race and color. Any discrimination shown to a human being on account of the color of his or her skin constitutes, he says, loathsome barbarity. Right, the Mishnah we just quoted, A vote 318 implies that every human being, regardless of religion, race, origin, or creed, is endowed with divine dignity. Consequently, all people are to be treated with equal respect and dignity. Again, it's, you know, pretty straightforward and simple. We wouldn't have thought otherwise. But here you have actual sources that indicate human dignity exists across all bounds. There is... another source, when we talk about, in the Torah, when we talk about the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, right after, you know, the glorious, you know, giving of the Torah with lightning and thunder, etc., right after that we talk about very basic rights, workers' rights, civil rights, individuals' rights in the Parsha of Mishpatim, right? All about treating workers and not charging interest, and if you're going to charge collateral to someone, you have to be careful not to, like, if you're taking a shirt as collateral, if it's cold out, you have to give them back the shirt every night, right? The idea is that we're very concerned with other people. So one commentary says that it's a central tenet of halachic civil law to prevent the exploitation of one who is disadvantaged, incapable of safeguarding his own interests, right? The litmus test of any idealistic system of civil law is in how it protects its weakest link, its most vulnerable population, right? And also we talk about the widow, the orphan, and the convert, specifically in the context of celebrating our holidays. We say that we emphasize our obligation to include them and to support them, right? And again, specifically when it comes to our personal celebration, not to forget those that are perhaps having a more challenging time, a more vulnerable time than ourselves. So there you see, at least three sources that talk about the dignity of every person, the protecting the vulnerable, right? And there's probably 100 other sources that talk about this. Even the idea that for certain laws can be disregarded in the face of the honor of people, kavod abriot, right? That I'm forgetting the exact situations, but you have where a kohen, right, who's not supposed to become ritually impure, if it comes to helping another person, he can perhaps become ritually impure to help another person, because that's the import. That's how important it is to protect other people and their dignity. So if anyone has thoughts or questions on that,
I don't understand that. How can you become impure?
Oh, you're talking about that example specifically. So it's complicated, but there's a injunction, there's a prohibition, ideally, and on a basic level, for a Kohen, like a Jewish priest, to become ritually impure. How do you become ritually impure? So usually it involves something related to death. So like a corpse, a Kohen should not come into contact with it. Or like a sheretz, which is like a dead insect, if he's like in the same room. Or again, ritual purity and impurity is hard for us to understand, especially we're not in the biblical temple times. That's definitely true, because we can't really relate to it.
Well,
but
it's a matter of interpretation.
Right, but it clearly, if you look in the Bible, if you look in the codes and everything like that, it is a very important part of temple service to be pure. Again, ritual impurity, it's hard for us to grasp the meaning of it and the concept of it because we don't really deal with it. But you can't deny that it's definitely part of Judaism. Sometimes, I don't know if they have it here, they have it in Baltimore, a Kohen who is visiting a funeral, right, attending a funeral, can't necessarily, or can't be in the same room as the coffin. So they need to do... So in Baltimore, at least...
And what's the reason he can be outside that he's a Kohen? Why?
Okay, hold on 1 second. I'll address that in 1 second. So in Baltimore, they made like a separate room, but like you can see right in and you can hear everything, but it's just like a separate room. Okay, so what's behind it? You could say it's...
tradition.
No, it's the idea is that, and I can't give you a full answer without revisiting the sources, which I like to do before I give a complete answer. So with that caveat... it's the idea that a Kohen serving in the temple is supposed to have a special, spiritual high level, higher than other people. So while, it's not necessarily ideal for anyone, even a non-Kohen, to become ritually impure because then it affects certain things you can do, but a Kohen is supposed to be on a higher spiritual level. Again, it's hard for us to relate to what exactly it is. But that was just like an example I gave. But my point was that he can disregard that in certain circumstances when it comes to Kavod HaBriot, when it comes to honoring the dignity of other people, right? So that just shows you the import and the importance in Jewish law, even of helping those that need help. So now I want to turn to the sheet and actually start with the chapter in Exodus, right? The seven verses, seven psukim in Shemos, which we just read a couple weeks ago. So I'll just read it in English. And you'll recognize this story, but it'll tie into this next and last topic we're going to cover, which is civil disobedience, which is the right of people to kind of stand up to the government in the name of justice. So it says, King of Egypt, Pharaoh, spoke to the Hebrew midwives. One was Shifra and one was Puah. Now, Shifra and Puah are identified by Rashi as actually Yocheved and Miriam, right? The mother and sister of Moses and Aaron. And so, but they were given these names, but that's who they were. Anyway, they were the midwives for the Jewish women. And he said that when you assist a Jewish woman giving birth, you should be right there, right where they're giving birth. If it's a son, you should kill him. If it's a daughter, then they can live. So why, I'll ask you, why a son was to be disposed of, but a girl be allowed to live?
I don't know.
Does anyone know? Why didn't he just say...
Because the woman is producing...
Yeah, but if they don't have a man, they can't reproduce.
Yeah, well, this can be a corroded thought there, too.
Right. Okay. So I think the answer is that they were afraid of who's going to be the Jewish leader, right? And so they knew it was going to be a baby boy born around this time. So Pharaoh said, let's, stop this before it starts and just get rid of all the boys. But the girls, he wasn't as afraid that that would happen. Okay, so, but then it says, the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they saved the men. They didn't do it, right? They weren't going to do it, and they risked their lives to save the boys, right?
So people go.
Right. But you see over here, what do you see? You see civil disobedience. The fact that they took the initiative and said, what you're saying to do is wrong and morally bankrupt. There's no way you can justify doing this, and therefore we're not going to participate. At the risk of their own lives, of course. If Pharaoh knew what they were doing, I don't think it would have been good for them. But they didn't care. So then he asks them, what are you doing? I see the boys are alive. You better have a good answer for me, or it might be the end of you. I mean, he doesn't say that, but you know, that could very well be what he's thinking. So they give an explanation. Jewish women, they come up with a very clever idea. They say, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. Again, and then it says they're lively, chaya, which has different interpretations as to what it means in this context. But it says they deliver before the midwife can even come to them, meaning they deliver the baby so quickly.
Right.
Like, you know, we can only be in one place at one time. So we're here, and then, you know, five houses down, you know, we heard we were going to go, and, like, you know, after we helped this lady, we were going to help over there. By the time we got there, the baby was already born. And so then the question is, well, why couldn't they just grab the baby? Well, Pharaoh said to do it right when they were being born, just to take it. Another question is why Pharaoh thought that they would listen. But, okay, maybe he thought that they would be intimidated. They didn't listen. And apparently it was somewhat of an excuse to say that they were already born. And therefore it was too late. Why couldn't they grab the kids at that point? I don't know. It's just an excuse anyway. Also, we know that with Moses, his mother hid him away, right? I think it said she hid him away for 3 months or 6 months, but then she couldn't hide him anymore. So the point is that maybe the boys were already born and they were hid somewhere and they couldn't find
him. Why would they hide him?
Because the Pharaoh's people were coming, were looking for them to take them. So again, these are the boys. Okay. So, and God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied, and they waxed very mighty. They just kept, you know, reproducing. They kept you know, becoming greater. The Jewish people kept having
more babies.
Yes, the population grew. And it came to pass, because they feared God, he made them houses. Now, this verse is kind of interesting. It's hard to know what it means, that they were rewarded with houses. So the homiletical interpretation, the midrashic interpretation, is that they got the houses of the Levites, right? Levi and Kohen, right? Because that's who their children you know, became, you know, the Kohanim and the Levian. So that's what it means, houses. It's not literally houses, it's metaphorically houses. Or it could mean that he gave them houses. I don't really know how, you know, what that means exactly, but okay. They were rewarded. And then Pharaoh said, again, every son that's born should be thrown in the river, and every daughter shall save alive. So again, Pharaoh reiterates what he wants, but now he's telling. Now there was a couple differences, right? Do you see the differences between verse 22 and verse 16? Right, it's both Pharaoh giving his command, but there's, like, I think two differences between verse 16 and verse 22. Right, so verse 16. First, he says that it's specifically when they're giving birth, that's when you should take care of the boys. Verse 22 is at any point, even when they're older. And also verse 16 is where it's he's only telling the Hebrew women. He's only telling the midwives. Now, in verse 22, it says he charged all his people to do it. So now, he has his own people, his own Egyptian people working for him in this, you know, nefarious, bad system. And so now it's even more dangerous for the Jewish people, obviously. And that's when you talk about Moses, Moshe being born and being, you know, put in the river, which is ironic because Pharaoh's saying, throw them in the river. And yet, when Moses is put in the river, but he's placed in the river, and who finds him? The daughter of Pharaoh.
Right.
And raises him, and then gives him to his own mother through his sister, who was standing at the banks of the river, to nurse him. Because the sister and Miriam said he really needs to nurse from a Jewish mother. So Yocheved gets her son back, and the daughter of Pharaoh is the one that's arranging it. And then she takes him back and raises him in the palace. So the whole thing is like unbelievable, like a movie. So what do you see from here? As I said before, civil disobedience. They were given a command and they decided we're not going to do it. Why? Because it's not right and we're going to stand up. Even if they were threatened. Okay? Fine. So now we just turn to a couple more sources that talk about... If we go on our sheet, before that, in the front of the sheet, so Mishneh Torah. So what is that? That is the Maimonides. That is Rambam, his laws. So there's a famous law that is called the law of the land is the law, right? Which means that even though, you know, Judaism has, we have our own set of laws, but at the same time, when they don't conflict, when the laws of the land, the secular laws of the land that we're living in, don't conflict with the Jewish laws, so we're told we have to observe both of them, both sets. Why? It could be for our own benefit, right? That, we have to watch out for our own, self-interests and health, and we can only do that if the government is treating us well. And so therefore we're told to observe the laws of the land. Or it could just be, the idea that maybe the laws of the land, the secular laws, are an extension of Jewish law. That, following the secular laws is perhaps a fulfillment of some Jewish law. Of maybe justice, right? We're supposed to pursue justice, right? Justice, you shall, go for. You should embrace. So perhaps included in that is the law of the land, right? That, if the law of the land says, don't steal, don't cheat on taxes, so then not only we should, just for our own benefit, not cheat on taxes, but maybe even because we're supposed to be just and everyone is supposed to give taxes, so then it would be against justice for each and every one of us to just disregard the tax laws. Okay? But there is one condition, right? What's the condition? So if you look on the sheet, the first law, the general principle is, here he's talking about when a king, because that's what he's in his time, and I guess he's talking in like the 1000s, 1100, that era, and where you have kings. Any law that a king decrees to be universally applicable and not merely applying to one person is not considered robbery, right? So he's talking about, taxes. Or other things that the king does to his people involving their money. You know, asking them for money or not asking, but forcefully demanding. So it's not considered robbery because the king is decreeing it and it's universally applicable, right? Meaning it applies to every single person. There's no difference in the people of the kingdom who it applies to, this law, right? Everyone gets charged taxes, right? Not just a certain amount, of not just certain people. However, he says, but whenever he takes from one person alone in a manner that does not conform to a known law, right? The king just says, oh, you people, you have to, you know, you have to give more taxes, or you have to live only in this area, right? Which we know, you know, later on, Jews can only live in a certain area, right? So if he makes his own law that applies only to a certain group or one person, and he seizes the property from the person arbitrarily, that's considered to be robbery, right? So in a brief little paragraph sentence there, he's basically saying that when it comes to the law of the land, the government's laws, it depends, right? Are they just or not? If they're conformed to the law, like they apply to everyone, so then you have to follow it. But when it's only targeting one group or one individual, then it's not considered to be justice, right?
So how does a king become a king and then he orders people around?
Yeah, so in the Jewish sources, so sometimes God anoints the king, like King David, he selects him. Other times it's passed down from father to son. Solomon gets it after David, and then Solomon's son, Rehoboam, he takes over after Solomon. So it's usually father and son. That's in the Jewish sources. And we know that, and again, this could be, we can do this for a future class about monarchy in Judaism, kingship, and is it a good idea, is it a bad idea, and what did the Bible, Tanakh, have to say about it? But we know, just briefly, that we had some kings that were really good and righteous and promoted, observance, and they didn't, do anything to harm anyone. And then we had other kings that promoted idolatry and forced people to worship idols and were not good for us. And so it kind of ebbed and flowed. We had some good kings, we had some bad kings. Now he can also be talking about not Jewish kings, but secular kings, which, okay, how do secular kings get selected? I think it's kind of also father and son. But it's also whoever has the power can grab the kingship, right? And then you have wars and battles, and one nation or one people, one group overthrows the other people, and then they become the king, right? So, whatever it is, And then if you look at the end of Halakha 17, the middle paragraph, it says that the laws of the king are binding, right? This was talking about back then when the king wanted to make a road or a wall or cut down trees, even if they belonged to private people, you can still use it because he is allowed to make those decisions. Now, hopefully he's making those decisions for the good of the people, that we need a bridge, we need a wall. And so, I'm sorry, Mr. Schwartz, I need to cut down some of your trees because we need to make a new road to get to this other place so that we can do trade with them and it's better for us. So, again, maybe it's not so simple. Maybe it depends on other factors. But the basic law that he's saying is that the laws of the king are binding. When does it apply? Halacha 18, last paragraph. And then he gives an example when the coins of the king are the tender of the land. Right? This indicates that the inhabitants of the land have accepted him and consider him to be their leader and themselves to be his subjects. Meaning, if, I think the money thing is kind of an example of a larger idea, which is that if the people accept him as the king and the money, they're not using I guess, like, private money. They're not doing their own thing. They're, you know, they're observing what the king is saying, and they're showing honor to him, and they're showing up at his parades. So then he's the king. But if, for whatever reason, he's doing things and the people aren't accepting him, so then maybe there's room to say that, you know, especially if they're not accepting him because they don't think he's just, he's not doing the right thing, so that ethically, so then maybe they can disregard what he says. So again, you have that tension between, basically, is the government, is the king doing the right thing? Then you have to follow the laws. But if he's not, and he's targeting specific groups, so then maybe one can subvert.
I like it that people had a voice.
People can subvert the law.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So now, so it's, as I said, it's a lot more complicated if you want to talk about the nitty-gritty of these kinds of laws with, you know, private citizens and the king and how they match together, right? We just quoted a couple paragraphs of the Rambam, but it's obviously a lot more discussion in the Talmud back and forth about that. But that's his conclusion. Now,
excuse me, Rabbi.
Yeah.
So he's saying that the people had these rights? That they could go against what the king said?
Yeah, so from a historical perspective or a practical perspective, he's not describing what one can specifically do to subvert what the king is saying to do. Well, if you look at 17, he's saying that you're allowed to benefit and you're allowed to, you know, use a bridge that belongs to a private person. Well, that is on the land of a private person, but that the king and the government decided to make on his land. But again, if they believe that what he's doing is correct and for the good of the people, so then you're allowed to use that. Because it sounds like if not, if it wasn't justly created, and the bridge, I don't know, you come up with an example of how he just wanted to build a shooting range or a target on Mr. Schwartz's land because it's beautiful. He wanted to build a golf course on Mr. Schwartz's land. For no reason. It doesn't benefit the people. It just benefits the king. So then, maybe one idea is that a regular person, another person, can't use the golf course, right? Even if it becomes open. Because that would be partaking in theft. Because maybe the king had no right to steal, to take, to build on his land. So, you know, you could say that that's a form of civil disobedience, right? To, you know, we're not going to use the bridge. We refuse to use this bridge. We don't think it's just, right? So now think about how that compares perhaps to, were there boycotts of certain government institutions in the 50s and the 60s with the civil rights movement? It would, right? So it would be analogous to, you know, a non-African-American sort of standing with an African-American to protest, right? To say that this is not right. So maybe you go back to Rabbi Heschel standing with Martin Luther King. I'm sure there's other examples also of how, you know, both African-Americans and others all stood together and showed, you know, disobedience. The sit-ins, right? So I believe that they were probably not just African-Americans that did the sit-ins, but I feel like they were joined by morally minded people, right, that wanted to join them. So perhaps that's similar to here. Again, whether one is... Here we're talking about not using the bridge. We're not talking about knocking down the bridge. Maybe that's something else. Because then maybe that would be going too far and endangering oneself. So, again, how far do you take it when you want to protest the government and they're doing wrong? So there's civil disobedience and then there's more violent. So once you step into the violent disobedience, then already I'm not sure necessarily how much support that would have, specifically in the Jewish sources. So I don't know. I think we're mainly talking about civil disobedience, right? The book of Genesis talks about our forefathers and foremothers, matriarchs and patriarchs. So one of the names given to the book of Genesis is the book of the upright, Yashar, right? Yashar, straight. So why was it called that? Because, as explained here, God prefers people who act in a way that is yashar, even in worldly matters, not those that act crookedly, which causes the destruction of creation, annihilation of the people's population, right? People that that thieve, right? That steal and that pillage, that's not what God wants. And so the praise of the patriarchs is that they were also yesharim, they were also straight. They conducted themselves towards others, and this is the point, even towards idol worshippers, who they despised, they conducted themselves toward them with love, and they cared about them, because that keeps the world in existence, meaning trying to look past differences for the greater good, that's what they did. For example, and this has always bothered me, this topic, but we see that Avraham prayed for the city of Sodom. The city of Sodom was terrible, right? There was theft, and there was just, it was morally bankrupt, right? Even though he hated them and their king, because Abraham was the epitome of doing kindness, of being right, of serving others. They were the opposite of that. And yet, he still sought their survival. He still prayed for God. Oh, maybe there are 50 righteous people in the city. Maybe there are 45, 40, all the way down to 10. And God kind of said, yeah, if there were, I would save them. If there were 30 righteous people, I would save all of them. All right. Or I would save just the righteous people. You know, different, you know, approaches as to what it means. But apparently there weren't even 10 righteous people in Sodom. Right, in Sodom. And so that's why it was destroyed. But Abraham was interested. So the question is, why is he trying to save them? Why does he care about them? So his approach is that there's competing values, right? People of Sodom were bad people. And yet, to pray that they die is, to pray that they live is maybe more important than then just letting them be destroyed, because maybe that's the right thing to do. So then what I want to say is that for sure, if you talk about people that did nothing wrong, that are innocent victims, all the more so how we're supposed to help them. Abraham tried to pray and help people that were doing wrong, right? And so when we talk about civil rights, we talk about the opposite. We talk about standing up for people that have been wrong done to them. So all the more so, Abraham would have stood up with those fighting for civil rights if he stood up for Sodom. Just to bring it back and to close with what we were doing over here with Maimonides, so he says, this is talking about taxes, all right? The right of the government to levy taxes is restricted only to a bona fide government, does not apply to any pirate who decided on his own to rob the masses in an organized fashion. Even when it is the official government levying the taxes, if the system of taxation is unjust, for example, if one segment of the population is discriminated against and is taxed more than the other, then too, this principle does not apply, right? And that's the rule. That's the idea of that the law of the government is law and is binding, but not the robbery of the government. So it depends. Is it a law or is it, is a robbery, right? And so, I would say, again, you can always have your different views about taxes, different political views, whatever, but, you know, nowadays, you know, taxes are, you know, we're getting a tax cut, right? So, if anything, the government is not overtaxing anyone specifically, but there could have been other times, like in the Talmudic times, when they were taxing people, certain people, too much. But I don't know if that's the case nowadays. So I don't think that there's any reason or any justification for those cheating on taxes nowadays. But there would be, theoretically, in a case where the government is acting immorally. Okay. So basically, just to sum up, we saw a lot of Jewish sources that talked about the dignity of man, of all human beings, and how we're all equal and not separate, right? Not separate and equal. As well as the idea to help the vulnerable, and also the idea of standing up to a government that is unjust, right? We talked about if the law of the land is the law, that only applies when it's a just law. When it's an unjust law, and again, maybe there's some gray area there, but I feel like in the times of the civil rights movement, restricting certain people to certain schools, to certain facilities, that kind of thing, right? Refusing, Rosa Parks that she couldn't sit at the front of the bus, right? Just these kinds of things are not just, and there's no reason for them, right? And no one did anything wrong. It was just the government kind of slowly needing to move forward from where it was in the 1800s to where it is now. And so the civil rights movement definitely pushed it along. And as we saw, we have Jewish leaders that helped in with that because they realized that the Jewish way is to help those, especially those that are vulnerable, no matter who they are.
How about the discrimination against Jews compared